Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
He kōna i purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
In the basement of GNS Science in Lower Hutt, the last bits of equipment are being put into the back of a van. Well, mostly just one type of equipment.
Cables, more cables for different cabling things, and spares of everything. You can't, there's no Mata 10 in the ocean. You can't go get spare stuff, you've got to bring everything with you.
Kia ora, nau mai haramai ki te ao hurihanga. Hello and welcome to Our Changing World. Ko klakin kanan tēnei. Andrew Boyes is a senior technician at GNS Science, and he's been helping to get the last few bits together for this expedition.
There's a lot of yellow cable, and it's all to connect up to a magnetometer. So that's that big shiny metal box there. Inside that is a big orange, it looks like a missile, honestly. And it's a magnetometer, so we tow that behind the boat, and it measures the magnetic field of anything around it. So there's a lot of yellow cable because you have to tow it a long way behind the boat, like three times the boat length, and then you need a backup cable in case something happens, like a shark has a go at it.
And has that happened before?
Yeah, we've had that happen to the magnetometers have been chewed up. You find like shark teeth in the fins that stabilize it.
They just think it's like a fish or something?
It's something, yeah. It's something fun in the water being towed behind a boat, pumping out electronic signals, so they smash it sometimes. But just curiosity, like they're not trying to eat it. They're just checking it out.
So yeah, extra cables in case of shark. Just one of the things to consider when packing for an ocean research voyage. It's for the fourth and final expedition of the Beneath the Waves program. If you listened to last week's episode, this might ring some bells. We spoke to Professor Ben Kennedy about communicating volcano hazards, and he's involved in the outreach part of this program. Beneath the Waves is a five-year, multi-organisation project to investigate the hazards from New Zealand's near-shore island volcanoes, Tuhua, Mayor Island, and Te Whakaari, White Island. Unfortunately, we know all too well the hazards with regards to Whakaari if people are on the island during an eruption. On the 9th of December 2019, 22 people died, and more were severely injured when the volcano erupted, when 47 people were visiting the island. But do these volcanoes also pose risks for mainland communities? Leading this program is GNS geophysicist Dr. Craig Miller. And the plan for this voyage is to grab a last round of measurements for mapping the anatomy of the volcanoes, so we can get to know them better, and maybe start to understand them.
I kind of have an analogy where it's like you're a doctor, you've got your stethoscope, you can measure a heartbeat, but you've never seen a heart, you don't know what it looks like, or you know you've got something beating. And so we're trying to do that CAT scanning of the volcano to discover the internal, the plumbing of it, so we can see, when we record this kind of signal, it's related to this part of the volcano. You know, that's fine, that's good, that's normal. If we see something different, we can then have all the context to understanding maybe this part here's changed, maybe there's fresh magma come in, and now it's doing something different. So it's really building the context to improve our interpretation of the monitoring that we already do, so that we can give better advice, ultimately, of say, hey, we've noticed a change, this is what we think it means, this is what could happen.
But how does one CAT scan a volcano sitting out in the ocean? Are you ready to get nerdy about geophysics? Because this stuff is pretty cool. First, you use some sensors that you put out on the seafloor.
Those are called ocean bottom electromagnetic receivers, and the measurements from it basically tell us the electrical conductivity structure of the Earth's crust. And that's largely determined by where fluids are. So if you put a fluid in a rock, it becomes more electrically conductive, and we can measure that. So we're actually measuring variations in the Earth's electric field and magnetic field. And then there's a bunch of complicated maths and computer stuff that happens in the middle, and then we get a 3D model of where these conductive areas are. And that's what we then try and interpret as, well, we think maybe this deep conductor is some kind of magmatic brine. Maybe this shallow one here is a hydrothermal system. So we can kind of interpret the volcanic plumbing from the distribution of these conductive and resistive areas in the Earth's crust.
These sensors can paint a low-resolution picture of what's going on 20 to 30 kilometers into the crust. The researchers also have versions that they can tow behind a ship or sling under a helicopter, which work in a slightly different way to give them detailed information about the first couple of 100 meters. And of course, there's our cabled friend, the magnetometer.
Volcanic rocks in particular are quite magnetized, but when they've had these hot hydrothermal fluids go through them, they demagnetize. So by kind of towing this thing back and forth across areas of the volcano, we can map these magnetic and non-magnetic areas and see, oh, there's a big chunk of demagnetized rock here. This is where either hydrothermal fluids are currently coming out, or where perhaps in the past this has been hydrothermally active and now it's, you know, that activity's moved elsewhere, but it's still kind of perhaps a weaker area of the volcano because the rocks have been altered, mechanically weaker, and those are the things that are more likely to collapse and potentially lead to tsunamis, for example.
They focused on two 30-kilometer square areas around each of the volcanoes. Tuhua is 35 kilometers north of Tauranga, while Whakaari is 48 kilometers off the coast of Whakatane. So they also took some sparser measurements across the Bay of Plenty to link them. But don't imagine, like I did, that they are detecting a big spider web of magma tunnels stretching out from Whakaari under the whole Bay of Plenty.
No, no, it's not like a massive lake of magma under the Bay of Plenty. It's like we have preliminary indication of kind of a small area out to the northwest, but it's just like maybe on half a dozen of these sensors. So we've got maybe 80 of them around Whakaari and maybe 10 at the most have some indication of something. For Whakaari, the way we think about magma under those kinds of volcanoes is just in little pods at different levels. Maybe there's a bigger reservoir at maybe 7 or 8, 9, 10 kilometres, and then there's small pods of magma kind of accumulated in the shallower parts, maybe around 2 or 3 kilometres. And then every so often, magma from the deeper part makes its way up into the shallower part. Maybe it stays there. But then every so often, the shallower part makes its way up to the surface. And then that's when we start to have these either phreatic eruptions, phreatomagmatic, or if a lot of magma comes up to surface, we have bigger eruptions.
What happened in December 2019 was a phreatic eruption. It's basically a steam-driven eruption. Superheated water trapped in the rocks is suddenly triggered to convert into steam. And this occurs rapidly and violently. The water converting to a jet of steam and expanding its volume well over 1,000-fold at supersonic speed creates so much energy that it's enough to shatter solid rock and eject debris and ash. Whakaari is New Zealand's most active volcano. And remember, we only see the top of it. 70% of the volcano is underwater. And we know that it's not erupted the same way across time.
Since probably around the 2000s onwards, it's had phreatic eruptions. So these kind of steam-driven eruptions, sometimes phreatomagmatic. So sometimes a small bit of magma makes its way to the surface. It interacts with the shallow hydrothermal system and we have like a one-off kind of explosion, like a small to medium size in the big picture of things. Whereas in the 1980s, up to about 2000, it was quite a different style at Whakaari. It was more magmatic, so we had magma close to the surface the whole time, and we had much more ash coming out more continuously. But obviously, to build like an island like Whakaari, you need bigger eruptions because it's a big island and it's had lava flows. So those are from kind of older periods of the building the cone, like thousands of years ago. And then compared to Tuhua's last eruption, we're not really sure. It had this big eruption around 6,500 years ago. But then there's these lava domes that infill the crater, and they're much younger. Maybe, we don't really know. This kind of part of the work we're doing here with other people is to date some of these rocks, possibly within the last 1,000 years or so. And these are kind of these dome-forming eruptions. So it's when this kind of unique magma that Tuhoa has kind of oozes out of the ground, forms these kind of domes that pile up on top of each other, small lava flows. Probably had some level of explosivity as well, but mostly kind of just oozing out, like the squeezing the toothpaste tube and toothpaste comes out the top.
Fun volcano science terminology fact. When it's under the ground, molten rock is called magma. When it comes to the surface, it's called lava. I made the mistake of mixing them up. Now you know. For each volcano, the composition of the magma is a really important factor in how they erupt. And Fakari and Tuhua are quite different.
We tend to classify volcanoes via the amount of silica they have. So silica dioxide is the dominant kind of constituent of magma. So volcanoes like Tuhua would have probably 70-something percent silica, which is very high. Nearly three-quarters of the rock is made up of silica. Whereas for Fakari, it's probably more like 50-60%. Something like Auckland volcanoes, it's down around 40-50. That's the range based on the silica composition, and that silica rarely determines the type of eruption that you're getting. So the low silica basalts, much runnier, you get the lavas. That's like what's erupting at Iceland at the moment. Whereas the really high silica is the really sticky stuff, which forms like pumice when it erupts, like out of Taupo and those sorts of things. So Fakari's kind of in the middle, and Tuhua's more like the Taupo kind of magma.
On top of that, Tuhua's got some other funky chemistry going on. The name Tuhua is the Te Reo Māori word for obsidian, the volcanic glass found on this island, a result of fast-cooling lava flows of its special type of magma. And the shape of the island tells a story of its eruptive past.
Tuhua's had caldera collapse in the middle, so that's where there's been big eruptions that have basically drained magma systems underneath the island and then caused the ground above them to collapse down, forming these calderas. So that's like what we have in Taupo, Okataina, Rotorua, but kind of on a small scale at Tuhua.
But what if you wanted to know more? What if you wanted to go back to the past and figure out when these volcanoes erupted and how big those eruptions were, and importantly, how far the effect of those eruptions were felt? What could you do? In the National Isotope Centre in Gracefield, Victoria University of Wellington PhD student Jacqueline Gretsch-Lacari, Master student and research assistant Keha Nickel, and senior research fellow Dr. Simon Barker are wielding a geotech splitter. It's slicing through the plastic core liner that surrounds a sediment core taken from the seabed floor. Think of a 90-centimetre long straw, 10 centimetres in diameter, with caps on each end. The inside is filled with mud and gravel punched out of the bottom of the Bay of Plenty. The team are splitting the straw in half, lengthwise. Once the plastic jacket and caps are cut, it's time to slice the mud. Simon explains.
There's two different ways. You can either run like a cheese wire through it to slice it in half, but we've had this special sheet of metal or a guillotine made up, because a wire, if you pull it through, can actually pull ash and material through the mud, but we want to have it all intact of where it originally sat. So we got this special guillotine made up, which you can essentially just press straight through the layers and perfectly slice it in half. Mm-hmm.
Jacqueline and Keha wheel the guillotine.
3, 2, 1, go. Beautiful. This one, for obvious reasons — by obvious reasons I mean there's more material in it and it just looks more beautiful — will be the archive hub. This one has some material that was sloshed around, so will be the working hub. Yeah.
As Jacqueline said, once the cores are split, one half will be left untouched. It'll be stored somewhere nice and safe for future investigations. This is the archive half. The working half is what she gets stuck into, looking for clues to solve a number of puzzles. She's got some lined up on a table for me to have a look at.
So we have different cores, both from Vaccari and Tuhua. We can start with the ones from Vaccari first, so these two. As you can see, they're quite different from each other, and this is basically because they're from two different sides of the island.
So one looks quite, it looks like mud to me.
Yeah, so for the most part, it is olivey gray, very clay sort of mud. And then within the mud, you can see that there's black layers, some of them quite fine, like the scrub you'd have on, let's say, that you'd put on your face, whereas some other ones are much coarser, almost pea-sized in some cases. So these are all potentially units from Vaccari eruptions. And so what is very interesting about these layers is that in some of them you can also see some shell fragments, which is not something that you'd see very often. And we think that this could be because rather than an ashfall, which is when the ash is going up into the atmosphere and then depositing and filtering through the water column, what we have here is a flow, a debris flow. So basically it would erupt and the column collapses and then it channels itself through the water and as a result picks up lateral movement essentially, and that's why we have shells in there. And it was something that we were not expecting to see.
There are 38 cores in total, between 3 and 5 meters in length, split into these 90 centimeter sections, and they've been taken from around the two volcanoes, some close by and some further away. Mud is laid down on the seabed floor over time. But when an eruption happens, ash is flung into the air, then settles down through the water column onto the seabed and forms an ash or tephra layer that you can actually see in these cores. What Jacqueline has just pointed out, this layer with shells, they suspect is evidence of a debris flow as in a result of an eruption. I gotta say, I find it pretty cool how she can look back in time just by using this tube of mud.
Another thing that we're seeing, specifically in this core, is that there is both a white layer followed directly by a black layer underneath. And what is interesting about this is that this probably indicates that there were two eruptions happening at the same time.
Remember Craig said that they classify volcanoes based on how much silica is in the magma? Well, low silica gives you dark, runny lava. High silica, you get lighter coloured, sticky lava. Vaccari is kind of in the middle of this spectrum, and it leaves layers of dark ash.
In stark contrast to that, the layer just above it is white with some black bits in it. And the reason for this is that it's likely from the mainland, and therefore it would be very useful to us because once we do some chemistry on it and we know which eruption it comes from, eruptions from the mainland have already been dated very well, and so it will serve as a marker layer for us to know where in time we are in this sequence.
Dating these is actually the last puzzle on Jacqueline's list. First is finding these ash layers and taking samples for chemical analysis. Like a fingerprint, each volcano has its own chemical signature, so she'll be able to figure out which is which. Some of these ash layers are too small to see, so she'll also put the core section through a type of geochemical scanner at the University of Otago to find smaller crypto layers. So that will give her the number of eruptions going back thousands of years. Jacqueline reckons the mud in some of the cores, in areas with low sedimentation rates, could go back 20,000 years. But what about the size of these eruptions?
One important parameter that you can immediately tell in terms of how big an eruption was is the thickness of a layer and also the grain size of it. So as you can see between the core I've just showed you from Vaccari versus this core I have here of Tuhua, the layer here is not more than 5 centimeters thick, whereas this one is a 90 centimeter section of a core that consists entirely of a deposit of tephra or ash, which indicates that this was likely a much larger eruption than the one we are seeing here.
Wow, okay, so there's a core that just kind of has dark, coarse grains in it, and you're saying that that's likely entirely
one eruption. Yeah, so in fact, actually, this one isn't just one section, so it's a core made up of 4 sections, and this tephra unit or ash unit starts at the very bottom of the first section and keeps going all the way through the through to the fourth section, and we can't even see the base of it. It's very proximal, which means it's very close to the island, and likely it's also in the dispersal axis of the eruption that we think it represents. We actually think it's the 7,000-year-old eruption from Tuhua itself. We were expecting some large ones from Tuhua in particular, so we know that Tuhua has had some larger eruptions than Vakari, just less frequent and less recent, but we did not expect the extent of this, at least not in the core.
We're looking at one 90-centimeter section, but when she says they see it in four sections, this means they captured several meters of ash and debris from just this one eruption. Here's Simon.
This layer here isn't just fall material coming out the sky. You can see that there are whole shells preserved in here. So this material has come sideways and brought material off the slopes of the volcano. And if this is 2.5 meters thick here, that's a lot of material being deposited off the volcano and potentially generating tsunamis towards the mainland. So what Jacqueline's found here is quite remarkable in terms of it's the first time these types of deposits have been found around the seafloor of the volcano. The equivalent ash from the 7,000-year eruption is preserved on mainland New Zealand in Hamilton, in bogs and lake cores, in the Coromandel, and it's quite a unique marker bed across New Zealand. But because it's an island, we don't know what the deposits are close in. It's also quite an odd event because it goes off to the west. So the dominant wind direction in New Zealand and in the Bay of Plenty are westerly winds, which blows stuff off usually to the east. So in this case, the thickest deposits were off to the west. So it actually went back towards mainland New Zealand rather than going off into the ocean. Especially the pyroclastic flows seem to only be on one side of the volcano. So it's a really, really interesting story.
A pyroclastic flow is the name for a fast-moving and super hot mixture of rock, gas, and ash that can travel rapidly away from an erupting volcano. Think of all this stuff being flung up into the air during an eruption and then coming back down and flowing down the sides. On land, they're incredibly destructive. The bonus of Jacqueline having so many cores taken from both close by and further away is if she can match up the layers, she can paint a picture of how far the effects from each eruption went. Once she has these ash layers mapped out, she'll then try to date them. She'll start with those white layers from mainland eruptions that there are already dates for. But to fine-tune things,
that's when shells come in. We've been finding some very well-preserved shells from very tiny, like a few millimetres across, up to like 4 centimetres in size, as well as shell fragments. And those we will try and do radiocarbon dating on. This will be aided with sediment samples, basically. I will be picking out microscopic foraminifera shells, which are basically carbon shells. And that will give us more detailed timelines as to what erupted when.
Okay, so end of the day, after a huge amount of work, you're going to end up with a kind of a map across your cores and back in time of different sizes of eruptions that have taken place across different times. How does this help us?
So it's very useful, especially given the proximity of the two volcanic islands to the Bay of Plenty area, once we know how frequently certain eruptions of a certain magnitude happen and where they usually disperse to. We can tell what the likelihood is that the next eruption brings ash towards the mainland. And this is important both from a health perspective, obviously if you're breeding in ash, that's never good for you, but also from an agricultural perspective. For example, and particularly for Tuhua, its chemistry, it's quite acidic. It has a lot of fluorine and chlorine in it. So as a result, if you get quite a bit of ash settling onto the soil, it can change the acidity of the soil and affect agricultural productivity. As for Vakari, most of the eruptions we seem to see are a bit smaller, but they're also more frequent. And given that we're seeing debris flows and we know the way it seems to be erupting, that could indicate that we could potentially get collapses that could eventually cause tiny, but still, waves nonetheless, tsunamis that could again impact the mainland. And that's what we are doing, and we will be helping as well people from beneath the waves directly studying tsunamis with this sort of part of the puzzle as well.
This part of the Beneath the Waves programme is taking place at Massey University in Palmerston North. At the PELE, the Pyroclastic Flow Eruption Large Scale Experiment Facility. Here's programme leader Dr. Craig Miller again.
They've got this large scale simulator in an old warehouse where you can dump like a ton of hot rock down it. We've put a swimming pool water tank at the bottom of it. It's got all sorts of sensors around it, and we can generate our own tsunamis on a small scale with that. And we can then use that to kind of understand the detailed like fluid dynamics of how these things work. What happens when you dump 500 degree rock down into the ocean? You know, how does it generate a tsunami? We kind of then compare that to our computer codes to see, you know, can our computer codes, do they replicate what we see in these big scale experiments? And then even in turn, can we link that to deposits we might find in the core to show, looks like there's some evidence where pyroclastic flows have gone further than we expected, perhaps, from the volcano, or not as far as we expected. So it kind of helps calibrate, in the end, the geological observations and understand when we do modelling if these things try and occur, that our models are kind of accurate and going to give a good representation. So if we try and simulate them, and we want to see what the impact on the mainland is, we want to be confident that they're actually reproducing the physics of it, if you like, accurately.
Yeah, your model isn't spitting out some scenario that's just never going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah.
After 2.5 years of work, they're at the project midpoint. With this last voyage completed, the data collection out in the Bay of Plenty is done. And now it's number crunching, analysis, and modelling.
At the end of it, we kind of want to have a good understanding of the likelihood of, say, landslide-induced tsunamis and what their impact of where on the Bay of Plenty could be impacted, to what extent and how often is that likely to occur.
Thanks to Dr. Craig Miller, Jacqueline Gretsch-Lacari, Keha Nickel and Dr. Simon Barker. Ko Clerken Kanana Ho, Te Kaiho Tu O Tene Hotaka, I Afina Mai, A Phil Vine, Rawa Ko Ellen Rikers. I produced this episode with help from Phil and Ellen. Sound engineering was by Phil Benj, and Tim Watkin is executive producer of podcasts and series at RNZ. For more information about the project and links to other related episodes, check out our webpage, rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. And if you want to get in touch, you can email us at ourchangingworld@rnz.co.nz. And if you enjoy this show, you might also want to check out another of our excellent RNZ podcasts. In Sci-Fi, Sci-Fact, experts from the MacDiarmid Institute take an idea from fiction and see how it stands up to scientific scrutiny. A new season has just been released. Search for Sci-Fi, Sci-Fact wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Te nā koe I whakarongo mai. Thanks so much for listening. Ko Clerken Kanana Ho. Have a great week. Kia pai, Te Wiki.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.